Bat Segundo can't be with us for this podcast. Upon hearing the guest wrote a novel about small-town punks, he holed up in his motel room and refused to leave, claiming sonic dissonance. Thus, the mic comes to me, a rather solemn and boring figure who you really don't want to meet. So instead, we offer you a haiku, authored not by me, because I don't have a creative bone in my body. John Shepherd writes books. Go away, just leave me alone. John Shepherd writes books. It's not the best haiku, I know, but we gave $2 to a man in the street, and it was the best he could offer on such short notice. Anyway, here is the interview. This gentleman is more interesting than I am. I'm going to cry.
So I am here with John Shepherd, author of Small Town Punk. John, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm just doing splendid.
I wanted to first of all ask you, I wanted to remark upon what Daniel Green had said about this book. He praised the book quite highly, pointed out that it was somewhere in between kind of a novel of stories and a kind of conventional narrative, that it didn't necessarily just present alienated youth, but what it was like to grow up in Reagan America. So given that it operated somewhere within this kind of spectrum, I'm wondering if maybe you can talk about how this came to be and whether these spectrums were very much apparent when you were writing the book.
I'm not sure I thought a lot about it while I was doing it, but I was an illustrator once upon a time.
Oh, really?
And I thought of this book as, it's somewhat like making a painting. You start off with the canvas and then you paint on top. And then you paint another layer on top and another layer on top. And eventually, at the end, you have a painting. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way I thought of writing this book. I didn't write it with a plot in mind. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no plot in mind. And some people, like a reviewer for the Chicago Sun-Times, thought it was pointless that I had no plot, that there wasn't a South Park moment at the... I learned something today at the end. But I really don't believe it's a pointless book. Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written it.
Well, it is very anecdotal, and perhaps was this a factor? I know this started off with being self-published, and I'm wondering, did you submit the book initially through publishers, and was there any kind of positive buzz or anything? Or was it, it seems to be a fairly accessible sort of book for something that is so, quote, pointless, you know?
By the time I'd written this one, I was done with trying to submit books. I'd gone through the MFA program at the University of Florida. I spent about 6 years writing a book, and it was called Midnight in Monaco. And I'd submitted it a couple of times to a couple of different venues, Shannon Ravenel at Algonquin, and an agent that a friend of mine hooked me up with, Mike Newworth, and they both said, I believe, that it was too weird. So by this time anyway, I'd been reading a lot in the New Yorker, I'd been reading a lot of published books at the time, and I thought, I really don't fit into this.
Well, going back to this initial thing you said, where this kind of started off equivalent to a painting, I'm wondering if, did you draw from personal experience, or why? How did the anecdotal format come about?
A lot of these stories, these are compressed things. You know, like any fiction writer, you know, you're drawing from your life. And a lot of these were oft-told stories about when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I just took them, I molded them into little pieces. I wanted to have a little punch at the end of each chapter, and I wanted it to build towards something, though I wasn't quite sure what I was building toward. So it's from life, it's hyped up, it is what it is, I guess.
I think, though, there is a certain kind of thematic arc to this, because, for example, you have Buzz being sort of a vacillating atheist later in the book, but at the beginning of the book, when he and his friend are picking up those two girls, he actually capitalizes his when he's referring to this plastic Christ that's in the lawn. So certainly you can't tell me that there was no attempt at cohesion or thematics here.
I also have this little thing where I do things twice.
Uh-huh.
They're repeated things where the second time around you might recognize it from earlier on in the book, and you, what's he do? and I take something and I turn it a little bit. And each time I turn something, I'm trying to build towards something. Though I'm never up here in my frontal lobe totally aware of what I'm doing. I know I'm doing it, but I'm trying to build towards something. Maybe it's like a lot like painting. You know, you start off and you've got that very basic sketch on the canvas, and then you start putting down the paint. And as you're building on it, you take the finer brushes and you're putting a little bit of a layer there, a little more of a layer, a little more, and eventually it builds into something that maybe you hadn't quite anticipated.
Yeah. Well, every writer I have talked to has, in some sense, described this connection between the conscious and the subconscious, in the sense that you're consciously trying to put things in there, and then the subconscious thematics kind of come about. And I'm wondering if, in the course of these fine strokes that you're describing, how much of the subconscious of this book are you sort of aware of here in terms of, and what did you do to sort of bring out points, like, for example, repeating twice, as you've sort of suggested here?
Well, I always kept these things in mind, I suppose. And I would go back and read that point when I was going to move along later on in the book and repeat the point. I would go back and reread that. But I would think along as the stream of the book flowed along, I would think about how it progressed along that. Yeah, I don't know.
No. Let's talk about the stream of this book, because it is very much a sort of kind of free-flowing stream that leads to this culmination point during Buzz's last year of high school, essentially. And there are characters who kind of crop up who surprise us, such as the co-workers at the pizzeria. And I guess the question, maybe you can talk about how you pursued the stream and how did these characters kind of just announce themselves and you kind of return to them in a later chapter, or what happened to
them? I started off with the four main characters, and I thought of them trapped out on this road without a way of getting out, and they had to figure their way out of getting out of this muddy ditch.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the book itself. It's how do you get out of the muddy ditch? Mm-hmm. So there's conniving, you know, the sister mm-hmm. uses a little bit of conniving to get the boys to push her out of the ditch, yeah. You know, but there's also there's Hook or Crook, you know, maybe the whole book is about getting out of a muddy ditch.
Well, it's also like, for example, the sister character was very interesting to me because she's extremely assertive. She's extremely confident for herself. And I wanted to kind of talk to you about going back to this religion and going back to this kind of like sort of assertive woman who then becomes sort of popular in high school later on in the book. I'm wondering, were these efforts to sort of reflect the world in the book, or were these efforts at a kind of larger tableau of Reagan America?
She was Sissy, the yeah. sister in the book, was based on my own sister.
Okay.
And my sister was a very assertive human being. She she got her way.
Yeah.
All the time. Even when she was a toddler, she got her way. And it was just sort of... a lot of the book was a tribute to her. She was murdered in May 27th, 1992. Mm. And... at a Pizza Hut, ironically enough. And I wrote this book 10 years after she was murdered. It was after 9/11. Which kind of shocked a lot of people, and it did me. Yeah. And I'd had this book in my head for a long, long time. I mean, I'd been talking about this book for at least 10 years, even longer. Even before Nancy was murdered, I'd talked about this book, but I never could get the nerve to write it all down. And at some point, it shocked me out of my complacency. 9/11, and it was coming up on the 10th anniversary of my sister's murder. Yeah. And I finally decided, I'm going to write this. I'm just going to muscle my way through and write this thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do what I did with Midnight Monica, which took me 6 years to write. I'm not going to sit there and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. I'm going to write it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to write it the way it is in my head. and it's going to, and it did actually come out on paper better than I thought it was going to come out, actually. Yeah. And, but I felt like I had to muscle this thing through before the 10th anniversary of her death, and it did.
How long did it take you to write this first draft? Did it kind of come in all one great rush?
This is a first draft, and it took 4 months.
Wow.
I would wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, mm-hmm. and I would sit there and write until I had to catch the train to work. Mm-hmm. And then I would come home at night, and I would look at what I wrote, maybe change a couple of words, but then I would wake up again at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'd start writing again. Mm-hmm. And that's how I wrote the book. Initially, I had this idea, too cute idea of writing very short chapters like they were all punk songs.
Yeah.
But it does what it does. You know, you start writing and it's like, this is the way it has to be. And it was trapped in my head that way anyway.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about that. The chapter names are named after a number of various punk songs, Guilty of Being White, etc. And you had remarked on Large Hearted Boy's book notes that you had been listening to essentially a mixtape that a friend of yours had given to you a decade earlier. So I'm wondering if music was a way for you to kind of hone in on these particular characters. Is it an essential part of you writing? Or
it certainly is. I mean, I remember I was in the army once a long time ago, and I was in Germany. I was walking past a restaurant. It was a Czech restaurant, and I could smell, and it smelled just like my grandmother's kitchen. Mm-hmm. And you see things all of a sudden the way they were in that kitchen. You can remember exactly where every ladle was. Mm-hmm. And music in this book served the same sort of purpose. I could listen to that music and close my eyes and I could remember it. I could remember it all the way it was. And of course I'm reshaping it all, but I can remember the way things looked. I remember the cars, the way they smelled, how bad they were. You know, I remember the smells at Pizza Hut and just the way you felt when you were there how angry I was.
Yeah.
Because it was like a lot of this book is about how you feel when, especially when you grow up Catholic, there's supposed to be this story to life, and you come to this point when you're in your teens, if you have half a brain, and you realize this is not the way things are.
Yeah.
This is wrong. I've been lied to, and you get angry. And that's what I was remembering through listening to that music, how angry I was.
Did you rely exclusively on memory to bring about this time period?
I sure did. I mean, it was the music. I'd sit there and I'd listen to it. I'd lay on the floor, listen to this music, 2 in the morning, mm-hmm. had it as loud as I could get it. And then I'd remember all sorts of details. And I think a lot of the book is very detail rich.
As loud as you could get it, I suppose. There's a certain kind of muzzling of this noisy punk music playing in the background.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
Did that kind of, I guess, it's interesting because it's like you probably, when you listened to it originally, you probably cranked that sucker up to the loudest possible, and here you are a decade later, and now you're sort of, I guess, muzzling it. Do you think this might have had a kind of influence to some degree? I have to just had to remark upon that.
I think it's the music itself, and not so much the loudness or the way I experienced it. Because I experienced it through I didn't experience it through headphones. I experienced it through the crappiest stereo you can imagine, and on vinyl and popping and my father pounding on, "What the hell is that?"
Yeah.
I remember my mother coming home one day from work and just shrieking at me, "You're killing me! You're killing me!"
Given these sorts of imperfections, do you think those imperfections in the audio kind of led to sort of maybe possibly filling in the detail? Do you need an imprint of some kind, of another form of media, to kind of tap into these memories?
No, it just listening to that music, I think I could hear it the way it was back then, even. You know, just to hear the music, and then I could reach back to then and remember the way it was. and remember how I felt. And that was what I wanted to put down a lot of in the book, was how I felt at that time, how angry I was, how I felt shorted. And we had this president who was obviously some sort of psychopath who was bent on having us all dead by the time he was finished.
Yeah.
And much like the present day.
Well, Proust had his Madeleine T, you had the punk music, I suppose.
Yeah. It was hardcore punk, you know. It was that second wave of punk. I think somebody said about, oh, you were in the first wave of punk. No, we were the second wave of punk. You know, the first wave of punk was almost a rehashing of old Ronettes tunes.
Yeah, yeah.
The second wave was, we were angry. Yeah. We were incredibly angry, and the music took on a different tone.
There's a fine line between Minor Threat and the Ramones, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to actually ask you about, so you worked in the Pizza Hut then.
Oh, I did. It was, The one thing I always hated was when somebody ordered anchovies on their pizza, because I would smell like anchovies for days afterwards.
Yeah. Well, in the course of the book, Buzz wears his Pizza Hut uniform almost like a uniform, essentially. Like, he's going away from work to these little parties and to the apartment and all that. Did you have a manager like that too, or?
I did have a series of managers, and one of them was a lesbian who had been to Vietnam. She was a right-wing a human being as you could. And I used to even say to her, one of the things that I said in the book about, you know, Mies is going to have you locked up. Mm-hmm. You realize that, don't you?
Yeah.
If he had his choice. But I also had a former Marine Corps sergeant as a manager. I had a guy named Chuck, who makes an appearance in here, who's the most beaten down man I've ever met in my life. And you'd look at him and you think, oh my God, could that be me in 10 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh no.
I'm wondering, because talking about this manager who does happen to be a Vietnam vet, that presents a very interesting sort of, I guess, ideological irony here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you feel that, I guess, in locking your crosshairs into your memories, that essentially political ironies and ideological ironies essentially just kind of make themselves known? Is this just the way you corral information, or?
It's just ironic that the Vietnam generation went and created this new war, that's another unending war. When I was a kid, the Vietnam War was on TV every night for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And they would have the little flags up there telling you how many people died in under each flag. And you thought at the end of it, oh, well, this'll never happen again.
Yeah.
And it sure as hell did.
But I guess, going back to the question I asked you, I wanted to talk to you about, in bringing up this information, these memories that you turned into fiction,
mm-hmm.
I guess these, is your mind more of in representing these kinds of ironies onto the page, or somehow transposing them? Do you just view memory within these kinds of ideological ironies, like this manager who, you know, also happened to be a Vietnam vet and also happened to be a lesbian, but yet at the same time, you know, had some right-wing sympathies?
I try to put things out there where people, I think a lot of people live almost ironic existences, and they don't realize it because they don't closely examine their own lives. And I suppose, because this is a detail-oriented book, I'm trying to put the details out there of people's lives and kind of squish it in there and show you, oh, look at this. Maybe we should examine our own lives too.
Well, there's also the irony of the punk label sort of attached to Buzz. I don't think he's even once referred to specifically as a punk, although he does listen to punk music. In fact, the thing that's very funny about him is that he has this unruly, unkempt hair that needs to be, you know, trimmed, essentially. He needs a haircut, and his sister, of course, wants to cut his hair. But this is something that I would associate more with someone who's into hair bands or something. I'm wondering, what is the punk label even important, or is it intended as this kind of irony here?
The punk label, later on the alternative label, you know, it doesn't, these are distinctions that don't mean anything in a way. It at one point there's a party in this book, and people come dressed as punks, you know, and look at me, I'm a punk. I've got the proper uniform on, and it's just, it's bullshit.
Well, you also have the moment where you have that party, and essentially the jocks show up, and they exist essentially to yell, hey, yeah, you know, throughout the entire
Woo!
Thing. I just wanted to ask you, I mean, were you, again, I observed in this book that there was a conscious effort on your part to really place people into these so-called labels where that not necessarily reflect them as an individual, but reflect them as a group. And going back to kind of, I guess I'm just trying to ferret out this answer in terms of like, you know, are these taxonomies just really tremendously important for you as an author in relaying a narrative?
I like to take these things, you know, these labels that people choose for themselves, and I believe that people in their teens somewhere, you know, I'm a jock.
Yeah.
And I like to take those things and I like to almost implode them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Buzz is sort of a punk, but he's not dressing like a punk. He's not, you know, a lot of what he does is not punk-like, you know. He's not straight-edged but I'm not quite there. I'm not quite sure what I'm thinking about here, but...
Well, let me see if I can help you out. Okay. You say you like to implode labels, and yet you also present them here in this book with all manner of ironies. And I'm wondering if this is sort of the right way for you to find not just humor, but also this kind of narrative that has a flow, even though it's kind of disconnected in a certain sense. I mean, or to kind of help you out further, here's an additional question. The punk label is clearly not necessarily important, but yet it also flows within this general taxonomic concern of yours in terms of conveying this narrative. I guess the question is, what does your mind sort of work within these sorts of taxonomies in charting any kind of fiction?
I think the way I look at these things are these are uniforms that people choose to put on, and they're merely clothes.
Yeah.
And oh God, it sounds horrible. What's inside is important, but it is what's inside that I'm most interested in, and it's tearing off those clothes and ripping through to somebody's heart.
Yeah.
And seeing what it's made of.
Well, the concern for aesthetics that Buzz has is very interesting because he remarks very much on the physical appearance of all the people around him, and yet he doesn't really reveal how he himself looks like except for the hair.
That's true. That's very true. And, well, Buzz is a very visual guy, like yeah. I was too. But he's an artist, he's a pair of eyes, a voracious pair of eyes, and he's looking for detail, and it's that's what interests him. He likes the little somebody who has a scar. He looks for the detail, and maybe through the detail he can see through to what somebody is rather than the broad strokes of them.
Yeah. Well, also, he also is very much into abrasive commentary on the actions around him, which is his way of trying to relate because he himself is misunderstood. And maybe this again goes back to this, I guess. I'm looking at this book in terms of taxonomies, and I'm trying to see if you as a writer actually wrote it with these sorts of similar kinds of structural kind of things in mind.
Well, his way of trying to strip through to the truth too is to be as abrasive
yeah.
as possible, because when somebody's angry, they say things that they ordinarily wouldn't say either.
Yeah.
And maybe something a little more truthful than what they would ordinarily say, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's also, the thing is it's also a way to sort of democratize in a weird sense the narrative, in the sense that anyone can pick this up, whether of having grown up punk or not, and essentially see this kind of abrasive commentary here that I guess all teenagers, to more or less an extent, share. Was reader accessibility ever a factor when you were writing, you know, or in the early mornings, or?
By the time I wrote this book, I was writing for myself.
Mm.
And it was something where I didn't care whether anybody else got it or not. By this time, I just wanted to write something that I myself would want to read, or my sister would want to read. Yeah, I always wrote just for an audience of one, and that was her.
Yeah.
And I wrote this book almost to her.
Do you feel that dwelling in the early hours when nobody else was awake was of help in sort of banging out the pages?
I was an insomniac for a long time, and you're almost in a fugue state.
Yeah.
When you're writing in the early mornings, and it you see things, you think more clearly, maybe, mm-hmm. or maybe it's just more like a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose I would have written a different book had I been getting a better sleep.
Did you grow up in Sarasota as well? Or?
I did.
And what did the sort of environment of Sarasota, relaying this through the book, I mean, again, going back to this visual element to Buzz's perspective.
Sarasota, when I was a kid growing up, was the former home of the circus, but it had a lot of circus people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the circus people have a sort of garish aesthetic.
Yeah.
Then we had these wealthy people coming down from up north, and they didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
But they also considered themselves the city of the arts.
Mm. You capture also the dreadful smell of orange juice late in the book. I'm taking that you went on ridiculous road trips along these lines, and also the run-in with the police near the end. I'm wondering, I guess, how much of this book was invented and how much, or was it sort of a kind of transmutation of personal experience into fiction?
Think of it as a salad or, I go back to the paint was my life,
yeah.
But the paint that as I put it on the canvas turns into something different.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to go into James Fry territory here, you know, and claim,
yeah,
this is exactly the way things were.
Sure.
But I think it is truer than a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that by condensing the experience and writing it out in the details as I did, that it's truer than a memoir could be, because it sort of strips down the life down to what it was.
I'm wondering, in terms of the relationship between painting and writing fiction, I talked to another writer who actually does this, and that's Dave King, who wrote The Ha Ha. And again, the similar sorts of, I guess, precision I observe in your book and his book in terms of these taxonomies, I suppose, or these very sort of rich characters that come to life. Maybe you can talk, perhaps, about the abstract nature of painting versus the more structural approach of fiction. I mean, there's a structure here, despite the fact that it is sort of a collection of anecdotes, I would say.
It's a bit more of a... I think a painting is more flat. You know, you're getting one image with a painting, and this is more a novel is more like a depth, maybe a series of images,
yeah,
that when viewed all together come up to a whole.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago I wanted to be a cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to tell people that, and they'd tell me that I was going to waste my life, but in a way, this feels like a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's a series of drawings that, if you flip through them, eventually, they were all on acetate,
yeah,
you could hold it up to a light and see a cohesive picture. But you have to think about it.
I'm wondering if you actually did any kinds of illustrations or drawings to kind of help you find a way to get inside the text.
I was in the Army as an illustrator,
yeah,
and the Army has a way of sucking all the joy out of anything you do.
Yeah.
So I actually stopped drawing a long time ago.
Really?
They murdered that within me.
Wow.
Along with any idea of camping.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go outside anymore and without thinking about, I'm going to have to dig a hole here, and I'm going to have to set up the tripod and the extra cans of ammo and dig a grenade sump.
So that was a good deal of resentment here that you could then transpose onto Buzz, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Buzz is like the orange juice concentrate that you smell as you're going down the highway. He's like I was, but he's more concentrated and angrier, and it's like maybe I was a slap and he's a fist.
It's kind of a doppelganger or a bizarro world version of yourself, maybe.
I think that's a good way of putting it.
I wanted to actually again ask about cultural connection. Like, I read, there are two sentences here I wrote down in my notes, and that is, Buzz writes this: "My main desire in life became to antagonize as many people in life as I could. I was a sour young man, filled to the nostrils with hate, hate, hate." Now, the fact that it's hate, hate, hate is very interesting, because this seems, on the offset again, like a personal sort of declaration, a declaration of emotions to some degree. And then yet, if you examine the fact that hate is repeated three times, and if you look at things like filled to the nostrils, there's this kind of interesting imagery that, again, I guess I keep seeing a sort of cultural language or a cultural vernacular represented in these particular sentences. And maybe I wanted to again ask you about that. Were you trying to kind of reappropriate language or show the kind of way that language kind of attaches itself to these sorts of slightly formed emotions growing up? Or?
That he has to repeat it three times?
And filled to the nostrils is quite a, you know, instead of filled to the heart, it's like a slight malapropism, you know.
Exactly. And in Catholic Church, you dump yourself in the chest at one point during Mass. Yeah. And there are these repetitions of things. You know, every Catholic Mass is almost exactly the same, too. And in a way, a lot of those things, you know, the repeating things, it's almost prayer. And it's the repetition of things. It's prayer-like.
Were you trying to insert these little catechisms as you were telling the story?
Yes.
Yeah. Did those come about by accident, or?
No, I thought about that. I was brought up a very strict Catholic. Yeah. My mother was. She could fill you with guilt from two states away, you know, and. The Catholicism, I wanted to drench this book in Catholicism, but almost an anti-Catholicism, where it's somebody who really resents being brought up Catholic, yet you're trapped in it. Yeah. Because once you're a Catholic, it's almost like an ethnicity. You are a Catholic.
And yet Buzz is very much on the fence, yet also capitalizing, which, as I observed earlier, I guess, how much of this was a sort of spiritual or religious purging to some degree, you know?
Maybe it's not a purging. Maybe it's more taking the language of the church and the feeling of being in Mass. And you know, the first time I stepped into a Protestant church, I looked down and I said, where are the kneelers? Why is everything padded? Where's the bloody Christ on a crucifix staring down at me, telling me I'm guilty?
Yeah.
And a lot of this book is, it's very Catholic. There's a masochism to being a Catholic, to going to Mass, to saying your prayers, to going into the little box with the priest who already knows who you are, even though you're pretending to be anonymous. And why'd you do that, John?
Well, in a weird way, Catholicism is kind of comparable to emo to some degree, in the sense that there is, like, you know, if you listen to Fugazi's Waiting Room, you know, I am a patient boy, I wait. There's a lot of violent sort of early emo music in particular is very comparable.
Fugazi's 13 songs, the first time I heard that, I said, that's it.
Yeah.
That is the perfect expression of the way I felt maybe my whole life, especially The Waiting Room. I mean, that was, you nailed it there.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to actually ask you, were other sort of punk novels along these lines, were other punk books kind of in your mind? Like, for example, you know, The Perks of Being a Wallflower?
Never read it.
Oh, okay.
No, I never read any other punk books or anything. I read part of Salad Days, Charles Romilotti, and it just wasn't very good, so I put it aside. But No, I didn't. I didn't have any interest in any punk books. I have my experience, and I had the name of this in my head for a long time too. The small town punk.
So really, the book, it seems, was a kind of way to, like a Roger Corman, basically making a title of a poster and then saying, here, make a movie with it. Essentially, the book was kind of similar to that?
A little bit, but it was, I came up with the name of it. I think I was in Austin, Texas with my buddy Vincenzo Murphy. Mm-hmm. And we were walking along, and his brother Marcello is walking along with us, and you know, I'm talking about this book. The book I still haven't written yet. He says, why don't you just write it? Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it was Vincenzo or Marcello who said, you're just a small town punk, man. It gelled a little more at that moment. But it's like that orange juice concentrate,
yeah,
boiling down. It took a long time for it to boil down. It finally hit that moment, you know, in the after 9/11. It was like, now I've got to write this.
Okay.
This is the time.
I wanted to ask one last question,
sure,
and that is small town punk, these phrases, these sort of Catholic-like sort of words, how do words figure into the nature of listening to music and conjuring up memory? Phrases, how does a phrase lock itself? Because again, like as I was observing earlier, there seems to be this very kind of you don't necessarily just choose words. You select phrases. It seems you select very, you know, long form units to insert very carefully into your sentences. And I wanted to ask if when you look at a sentence, how do you actually go ahead and create, take what do you draw upon for building blocks for these sentences?
I look at the commas. Commas are a nice pause, and it's a way of stopping somebody and making them think for just a moment. Before I have something, I'll even put sound effects into some sentences. You know, he shut the door, comma, thump. And I'm a freak about commas. And I also like hard consonants. I like a thump, and I like I also like the something to have a cadence to it. And maybe that's the army along with the Catholic Church. You know, this is the word of the Lord. I had when I was in basic training, we had a Catholic chaplain. He was a captain. And he did mass like a drill sergeant. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. And I thought he was wonderful. I just sat there at mass every week. Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
I don't believe a word anybody's saying, but this is great. This is great stuff.
Wow. So it seems to me that you respond very much to beats in a certain way. And that beats are a way for you to not only trigger the way of remembering, but the way of chronicling as well.
And flow.
Yeah.
And bringing somebody along through a work. I think it's important to be able to hit beats, to evoke images, to make them pause for a second, to consider what they've seen, and then move along. Long sentences that kind of flow a little bit, and then stop it up with a short sentence, and bang,
yeah,
hit some point. And then at the end of a chapter, I like to have a little twist of the knife or a poke in the heart with a sharp instrument, often a short sentence, just, this is what happened. Bang. And then move on.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, with that end of the sentence, John, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.